Back together again, you and I, Tuesday, the 2nd of May, 2023, right here on Connecticut Today. I opened with a few thoughts on a new poll from Wesleyan University that should be a big wake-up call for state Republicans. Republican State Senate Leader Kevin Kelly of Stratford dropped by to chat about the current tax and spending battle at the state capitol. We also talked with Erica Ahern, associate editor and co-host of the Loopcast at CatholicVote.org, on the one-year anniversary of the Dobbs case leak. See, if you just listen to me, and don't say he's just a fat, balding, pudgy, white guy on the radio. If you just put a little faith in what I tell you, things would be moving a whole heck of a lot smoother. I'm telling you, I should be. Maybe I am the unofficial governor of this state. I don't know. Maybe I like doing this. Just, 4 hours a day, Monday through Friday, 2 to 6, telling you what the reality is and telling you to get beyond your blinders here. Because when you look at the numbers, on some things, it's not often, but on some things, I'm right. And why am I saying this? Is it to toot my own horn? That's a crazy scene, by the way. You don't want to watch me do that. But am I doing this to toot my own horn? No. But every so often, when a story comes out, I go, aha, I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. Well, we had that today, right here on Connecticut Today, 203-333-9422. There is a new poll out there, and I know, well, it's just a poll, palm, blah, blah, blah. I know, but these things are instructive, because sometimes you have to see these things in front of your cute little eyes, brown, blue, black, one eye one color, one eye the other color, like Max Scherzer. He's a weird-looking dude. And somebody has to tell you this to take the blinders off, whether you're on the far left or the far right, especially the Republican Party here in Connecticut, of which I'm a member, and listen to reality. And I say this all the time, and I'm involved in some of these online groups, Turn Connecticut Red, Take Connecticut Back, Save Connecticut, Connecticut Patriots. And I sit here and I laugh. Like, what in the hell are you people talking about? Do you understand what's going on around you? Now, what do I mean? Let's take a look at some new numbers here. This is from a Wesleyan University, Wesleyan University poll. Wesleyan, they're in Middletown, a high up on the hill there in Middletown, right near the water there, right near the Aragone Bridge, a bastion of liberalism, all right? Wesleyan makes Yale look like Texas A&M. I mean, that's how far left Wesleyan is, which is fine. I know they have some fine folks there. Some very learned folks. But Wesleyan got together with YouGov, I guess, and they did some polling here. I guess they do online polling, but they screen people. So Wesleyan, the fine folks there in Middletown, got together, and they polled 600 Connecticut people. 600. Which, for a state the size of Connecticut, is pretty good. I know you're sitting there saying, well, come on, Paul, they never call me. They don't have to call you. You can poll a state with just a few hundred people. You can poll the nation with about 1,300. So it's far too complicated for me to explain to you here on a radio program, but trust me, it's there. Take a stat course. Take a probability and stat course. Ned Lamont. How is Governor Ned Lamont handling his job as governor? So that was one of the questions that was asked by the Wesleyan folks. And the governor gets a either strong approval or a somewhat approval of 60.1%. That's pretty good. That is a decided majority. 60.1%. 26.3%. saying they strongly approve, 33.8% saying they, somewhat approve. Somewhat disapprove or strongly disapprove, that is just 32.9%. 32.9%. And, of course, you do the math there, 60 plus 32, that means 7%, 60.1 plus 32.9. So 7% are undecided. Now, what does that tell you? What do those numbers tell you? Exactly what I've been telling you. Connecticut's governors, well, two things. The best governor for the state right now was somebody, obviously, who was socially liberal but fiscally conservative. So when 6 out of 10 people in this state say they like the job that Ned Lamont is doing, that's a lot of Democrats plus plenty of Republicans. So you folks out there, a lot of you who call me and a lot of people who belong to these groups who say, well, we're going to take back Connecticut. You ain't taking back Connecticut from nothing. Do you realize it is going to be next to impossible to elect a Republican statewide here for a long time to come? I'm not saying it's not going to happen. But again, the governor's got a 60.1 to 32.9% approval rating. 6 out of 10. 6 out of 9 who are willing to answer. 7% say they don't know. So even if all those 7% are in the no category, he still has a 20% plurality in what people think of him. So all you people that say, well, Ned's an idiot. Ned doesn't know what he's doing. Ned's a moron. How could people elect the guy? Well, guess what? You are in the distinct minority. So again, I'm not saying you're wrong to have an opinion here. I'm not saying that at all. God bless. Have your opinion. Debate it strongly and fervently. But don't, you know, say on these social media groups and at these gatherings, I can't understand who votes for the guy. No. You're in the minority of people who don't vote for him. Now, that does that mean he's the best governor on the planet? No, I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is sometimes what polls do, and I know you don't like polls, if the poll doesn't give you that, what is it, that confirmation bias, see with the numbers, see the numbers, prove I'm right. Well, sometimes if you don't see that, if the numbers don't prove you're right, you just tend to, like, fluff them off. Well, who would have answered yes to that? Well, apparently enough people. So the governor with roughly a 60 to 33, roughly rounding up and down when we have to, roughly a 60 to 33% desirability in the poll, 7%, and they ain't so sure. They ain't so sure. All right. What about the General Assembly? Now, what do I say all the time? I say this all the time to conservatives, to Republicans in this state. Stop putting all your energy in the governor's race, which you have almost no shot to win anymore. Stop putting all your energy, every drop of blood, sweat, and tears into the constitutional offices. It's going to be decades, I think, before a Republican has a remote shot at winning a constitutional office. By that, I mean Secretary of the State, Comptroller, Treasurer, Attorney General. You know what I mean? The constitutional offices below the governor, the lieutenant governor. What have I been saying to you folks who've listened to me on this station coming up on 4 years next week? How about that? 4 years next week, and previous to that when I was in Hartford and New Haven and all over the state. What have I said for years and years and years and years and years? The governor's race is the big sexy race, but the race you should concentrate on, or the race says you should concentrate on, are the General Assembly races. The races that you can have direct say on. The races where you can actually talk to the candidates at a town hall, at a committee meeting, at a local firehouse or local church hall. Why am I mentioning this? Well, listen to this question. Do you approve or disapprove of the job that the Connecticut General Assembly is doing, right? The 36 men and women who make up the state Senate, and the 151 men and women, it's kind of an odd number, but the 151 men and women who represent cities and towns in the state house. Well, how about this? In a state that is ostensibly a blue state, a very blue state, especially with the cities. Ready for this? Just 46% of those polled, less than 50%. 46% of those polled either strongly approve or somewhat approve of the job the General Assembly is doing. That's not even half. So you have a governor here who's got a commanding approval rating by 20 points. You figure, hey, the Democrats must be kicking arse all over. Well, they're not. The General Assembly that's run by Democrats with minority Republicans all over the place is only at 46% approval, largely on Democratic running for years and years and years. Disapproval, strongly or somewhat disapproving, is at 35%. So a full one-third of Connecticut doesn't like what the General Assembly is doing. Less than half does. So do the math. 46 and 35 is 81. So rounding it up, 19%. One out of every five voters in this state is not sure about the job that the General Assembly is doing. So if you take that 19%, couple it with 35%, what do you have? More than half of the state of Connecticut either does not like or isn't really sure of what our lawmakers are doing in Hartford. That is what has to be concentrated on. That is what has to be concentrated on. And that is why I'm telling you, that is why coming up in 2024, you need, and I'm talking to you, the conservatives of this state, the rank and file Republicans of this state, the people on the state central committee, the people that vote in the primary in this state, the people that are convention delegates. Again, what we see in these numbers is not a smorgasbord of I love you from the state of Connecticut, from a lot of voters anyway, into how things are being run. But one sure way to screw it up is to nominate a Senate candidate who's on the far right. Now, this couples in with the fact that Donald Trump has new numbers out there, and he's walking away with a nomination, which at this point to me makes me giggle. We'll talk about that later. But again, you have, at least according to these numbers, and I know it's one poll, but think about that. The General Assembly, where the rubber meets the road here in Connecticut, where the real changes take place that affect your life and my life and the lives of our friends and co-workers and family members, there's not even 50% solid support there. I'm telling you, we're a year and change out, and again, for the state Republican Party and you Republican voters in the state and you folks who are on all these conservative forums on Facebook and Twitter and all this, it's set up for you again, assuming you don't screw it up. Assuming, again, you don't nominate someone who is on the far right and has the blessing of Donald Trump. Because, again, trust me, if we're here a year and change from now talking about a Senate candidate to run against Chris Murphy, who's not going to lose anyway, but if you nominate some right-wing nut, you will drag every Republican candidate on the underticket down with you. Folks, it's just common sense. It is what it is, what it is. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You disagree with me on this? Are you part of that Republican enclave in the state that thinks we live in Alabama or Mississippi or Texas or Arkansas or Kansas? Again, I point back to the nomination of Leora Levy for the U.S. Senate. I'm sure she's a fine woman. She's been praised by people that know her. I don't know her. I did not talk to her during the last campaign. I'm sure she's a fine fundraiser, fine mother and grandmother. This is not personal. This is business. So again, here we are a year and change out. Governor Lamont has a pretty good approval rating here. And maybe Republicans and conservatives who cry and bitch and moan in this state all the time about losing elections, keep your mouth shut for a while and open your eyes and understand how this whole thing works. Ned Lamont is a social liberal, along with being a pretty hardline fiscal conservative. Yeah, that seems to be the recipe here, gang, according to these numbers. And maybe I'm praying, I've got the rosaries out, I've already got the candles lit to Ramadan coming up in 2024. Maybe there'll be some logic to keep the Connecticut Republican Party away from nominating somebody who was joined at the hip with Donald Trump. We've been talking taxes here, as a lot of people are on both sides of the aisle. So let's get it right from one of the guys in the middle of these negotiations, Republican State Senate Leader Kevin Kelly of Stratford, friend of the radio station. And interviewing Kevin is like when they do major league games now and they go to the manager in the middle of the game. Kevin, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul.
I can see you, Kevin, there with your cap on, the headsets on. You got your arm over the rail at the end of the dugout. So we're talking to you mid-game here. All right. So, Kevin, give us an update here. I know the Republicans, your side, is going to release a budget, but you're still trying to work on a plan that, you know, kind of helps both sides and a wide swath of taxpayers. What do we have?
Well, what we're looking to do is help middle-class, working and middle-class families get through what has been a very difficult time, both through the pandemic and now with a 40-year high in inflation, where, you know, you go to the grocery store and buy a dozen eggs, it's now, you know, $8, $9. It's ridiculous. And what that's doing is it's taking more money out of our pocket and sending it to Hartford, because the sales tax is a percentage of whatever you buy, and if the goods that we're buying are becoming more expensive, well, guess what happens? More money goes to Hartford, and just as we saw the consensus revenue yesterday, we're now $600 million more than projected. And so, you know, money is landing in Hartford's lap, but it's coming off the working and middle-class kitchen table. And so Republicans want to return that back to where it came from. It's really the government has planned its budgets. It's done what it can. I don't think people are saying the state of Connecticut is falling apart. And therefore, I think we can do a lot to return money back to the hardworking families that we represent.
Kevin, they say in any negotiation, I guess the general rule is there's stuff that either side will never agree to, stuff that both sides do agree to, and stuff that requires a little give and take here. Of those three columns, can you kind of update us on what's going on there in the status of the budget talks right now?
Well, I mean, Paul, that's looking at politics through what I'm going to call a status quo lens. And that's the way it's always been done. And when it's always done that way, guess who ends up being the big loser? It's the working and middle class families of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And I think rather than looking at it as, oh, these are things that Republicans won't agree to or will agree to, and things that Democrats won't agree to or will agree to, how about if for a change we start looking at conversations that say, what's good for Connecticut families? What's good for the people we represent rather than the parties we're associated? You know, when we stand for election, we might be on one team or the other. But as a member of the General Assembly, I'm the senator from the 21st District. And so I represent the folks that live in my district. And that's where I'm guided by and try to be the voice of those residents that ultimately, you know, is the very frustrated working and middle class families of Connecticut. And I think if we keep the focus on that rather than what the parties stand for or don't stand for, I think people will be more satisfied with the product that government gives them.
Yeah, a lot of folks in Wilton wondering about the tax and spending scenario in the state. Guy that checks in with us from time to time, Republican State Senate Leader Kevin Kelly of Stratford. Kevin, a couple of things. Let's talk about I'm reading reports here of a push to go a couple of $100 million around the spending cap, how that would be done by taking funds into and out of the cap coverage here. Talk a little about that. What's the deal with that?
Sure. Well, let's put in perspective, Paul, first. The whole purpose and where the spending cap comes from. Remember the imposition of the income tax back in the 90s?
Oh, yes.
Well, part of that also, the people asked that, you know, and passed the constitutional amendment that the General Assembly define a spending cap. And then for the next, you know, 20 years, the majority Democrats never did that. It wasn't until the Senate was tied in 2017 with Republicans and Democrats sharing power that we finally got the spending cap definition in place. And we had the bond locks were there, these spending caps, the guardrails were put in place. And we just 2 months ago reenacted them to go forward for another 5 years. Well, guess what? The majority Democrats are now at redefining that definition. And they want to take money outside of the spending cap, redefine it. And it's not just a couple $100 million. That's what we know of. It could be as much as $1 billion, Paul, to get out from underneath the spending cap. And that's how we got to this whole position now where we have a full rainy day fund, a balanced budget, and we're paying down our pension debts. It's because of the guardrails that were put in place by Republicans in 2017. And now the majority is trying to unravel that. And we all know that until the past couple of years, when the benefits, the fruit of that compromised budget from 2017 started to work for the taxpayers, well, before that was the permanent fiscal crisis of the Dan Malloy Democrats. And if you start messing with these guardrails, guess what? That's where Connecticut's going to go back to.
And these guardrails, Kevin, were praised over the past few months by Governor Ned Lamont.
Well, it wasn't just Governor Ned Lamont. It was every single Democrat that I saw that ran for election last year praised about how they put these in place. They made a big point that we voted for, only half of the amount of tax relief. We voted for, you know, much bigger package. But that they were paying down debt, and that was such a good thing. And mm-hmm. This is, you know, they needed to go back to Hartford because they were fiscally responsible. Well, now it's time to talk the talk. It's time to walk the walk. Let's keep these fiscal guardrails in place. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, it's worked very well. They agreed on that, and that's why they were reelected. If you want to keep that, then they really should listen. Once again, like I said in the other segment, if we just stay focused on our constituents mm-hmm. who told us what they want us to do, Connecticut will be okay.
Yeah, Kevin, also, and Kevin Kelly is the guest, what is your perspective watching the disagreement here, I guess you could say, between Governor Ned Lamont and the people that run A, UConn, and B, the rest of the state university system, which a lot of people may not realize is separate from UConn? The push here, Kevin, the doomsday scenarios that are laid out every time this happens, what are your thoughts here?
Well, you know, Paul, the thing that we have here is we have to understand, you know, what the environment is that's going on. And this is not just acute to UConn and the Connecticut State College system. It's also something that's felt by Sacred Heart, Fairfield, Albertus, mm-hmm. Quinnipiac, any other university that's in the same space. And we know that the enrollment in the Connecticut State College system is down about 25%.
Wow.
UConn, obviously, with a national championship, has enrollment going up. But, you know, when you start to lose 25, maybe 30% of your market, any company, any business, any entity is going to have to make adjustments. And that's kind of what's going on here, is they're having declining enrollment, but asking for more money to do the same job that they did when they had more customers, if you will, more students.
Mm-hmm.
How is Fairfield and Quinnipiac doing the same thing when they don't have taxpayers to go to and say, give us more money? I think they're making adjustments, being creative. We see in Fairfield University starting to have an associate's degree with Fairfield Bellarmine. And so you've got, you know, creativity going on in the marketplace so that they can survive and doing what they have to do. And I think it's a necessary conversation to have. We need to be focused on making sure that we have the best academic resources available so that we train our students and have a skilled workforce upon graduation. But at the same time, I saw bills, I sat on higher ed, and you see bills that are continue to add more people to the, you know, the college retirement plans, to make more adjuncts, full-time tenured professors, basically adding more cost onto the system, which puts more burden onto the institutions rather than looking at ways to do things more effectively and efficiently with less resources, just like every Connecticut family is doing, just like every Connecticut business does.
And Kevin, that adds long-term costs. I mean, you hire faculty members, you transfer adjuncts that are making a few thousand dollars a semester per class and suddenly say, hey, you're part of the state workforce. Well, it's not just what you're paying them every 2 weeks or every month, Kevin, right? It's those legacy costs that we're trying to get a hold of.
Right. Exactly right, Paul. And part of this conversation, which has been lost, is that, you know, in the governor's budget, he has taken those legacy costs that were put on UConn and shifted them over to the state to give them some more freedom and flexibility. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's this is a necessary conversation, I think, that has to be had. But we'll see where it ends up at the end of the day.
Kevin, thank you. Kevin Kelly, as always, keeping us up to date as to what's going on up at the Capitol. Kevin, thanks. Take care. Drive safely. We'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Hey, thanks.
All right. Appreciate it. All right, folks, there you see it. That's you know, the budget argument happening up in Hartford. And the result of that will, in some way, shape, or form, to some, you know, to some purpose or some perspective, affect what you and I pay with taxes. So there you go. It has been about a year since we had something unprecedented, a leak of a draft opinion from Justice Samuel Alito on what was called the Dobbs case. Remember this? About a year or so ago, the case that eventually tossed out a national recognition for abortion rights and said, listen, whether or not you favor abortion, that should go back to the individual states based on the theory of federalism. Well, a few days ago, Justice Alito told the Wall Street Journal that he has a pretty good idea of who leaked this thing, but he doesn't have quite enough the evidence to put somebody's name out there, and I think that's smart on his part. You really should err on the side of caution. But it's been a rather eventful year. Some people happy with stuff, some not. Erica Ahern joins us. She's associate editor and co-host of the Loopcast at CatholicVote.org. Get them online. Check out the stuff, CatholicVote.org, to talk about this, what has transpired in the past year or so. Hey, Erica, it's Paul at WICC. How are you? Thanks for coming on.
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
It has been a pretty eventful year with this. Not only did the Dobbs decision, Erica, send this back to the states, as many legal scholars actually on both sides of the aisle thought was the proper thing to do, but we still don't know who leaked this, and there's also the controversy is whether or not the federal government is doing enough to prosecute and investigate cases of alleged violence against Catholic organizations. So let's get started. Talk a little about that. What are your thoughts here?
Sure. So it's been 1 year exactly today since Politico got a hold of and published that 89-page document from Justice Alito that indeed confirms that the Supreme Court was planning, as they subsequently did, to overturn the Roe v. Wade decision that federalized abortion throughout the country through all 9 months of pregnancy. And as you said, this unleashed a storm of reactions almost immediately. As soon as this was published, we had groups like Jane's Revenge or Ruth sent us pledging a summer of violence, a summer of of lashing out, not only against the justices, but against anyone who they saw as emblematic of the pro-life movement. And so this included, of course, we've seen since a year ago today, there have been 152 attacks on Catholic churches, and 85 pregnancy resource centers have been attacked, including everything from smashing windows to bomb threats to graffiti with, you know, horrible sayings and vile words, and also firebombing and arson. So it has been a very eventful year. And of course, the attacks themselves show no sign of letting up. And as Merrick Garland testified on March 1st, his Justice Department still really has, you know, very little will, it seems, or interest in prosecuting these crimes.
Yeah, Erica, when he was confronted with this, and that was going to be my next question to you, where does that stand right now? Because I can only imagine, Erica, as proper would be, if you had 100 and change attacks on synagogues or Muslim mosques or Buddhist temples, I would think the Justice Department would be on their horse here trying to figure out what's going on. Not so the situation with Mr. Garland and Catholic churches?
Certainly, it is hard to resist the temptation here to feel that there's a two-tier justice system going on with Merrick Garland and the DOJ. One would think that, you know, a nationwide, and this isn't, these attacks are not concentrated in cities, they're not concentrated in certain parts of the country. They really are. We've had them now in 46 different states. And so it's clearly a nationwide phenomenon. And, you know, while local law enforcement have made some arrests in these crimes, the federal response has been lackluster at best. And it, again, it's difficult to read anything except a politicization here of the FBI and the DOJ on the part of Merrick Garland and the Biden administration.
A few more minutes here with Erica Ahern. Erica is the associate editor and co-host of the Loopcast at Catholic Vote, CatholicVote.org. Check them out online. The one-year anniversary of a stunning story that broke a year ago today. Politico publishing a draft opinion of the opinion that sent the abortion decision back to individual states. Erica, one thing in the wake of this that really drove me nuts, above and beyond everything else that's happened since then, was, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in perceiving it this way, Erica, was the rather kind of relaxed opinion and view and reaction of the media in America to what looked like some overt threats of violence at the homes of Supreme Court justices here, and, you know, the kind of the lax reaction of giving them the maximum security here. Of everything that happened here, Erica, to me, that might be the worst outcome here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even more disturbing than the leak itself is that the reaction to it has been, like you said, just so limp and like wet spaghetti, right? And so we have not only the, you know, in the protests outside of the justices' homes that continue to this day, and it's illegal in our country for people to protest outside of justices' private properties in order to influence decisions. But that's precisely what still goes on today in front of the home of Justice Kavanaugh, who was the target following this leak of an assassination attempt, the home of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. But also the lack of interest, the utter lack of interest from every existing authority to pursue an investigation to a swift conclusion of the leak. We still don't know. And despite Justice Alito's statement that he has a pretty good idea of who leaked the decision, the powers that be in our legacy media, in our Department of Justice, just seem ready to leave it there. And I think it's hard to stress the significance of this leak for its effect on the justices themselves in terms of their internal trust of one another, their trust of their law clerks, of their staff. It's hard to emphasize realize just the watershed moment that this marks in the American justice system and in our government. But we have no follow-up, we have no crime and no punishment. This during a year when the cries for investigation into the January 6th riots were so loud and so vitriolic. And not that those should not have been investigated, absolutely they should have been, but one would hope that that same passion would be brought to this crime that was committed and that arguably has more effect on the long-term success of our American experiment.
Yeah, and Erica, you're right. And in reflecting back on this, and I was reading over the weekend, Justice Alito gave an exclusive interview to the Wall Street Journal. And you and I both know, you know, the justices, you know, they go to colleges every so often and they give lectures, but they do not talk to media outlets a lot. So Justice Alito obviously made it, you know, thought it was important enough to speak to a major newspaper about this over the weekend, you know, saying, I think I know who did this, but I can't say, and good on him. That's good judicial restraint there. Yeah, but the fact that we still don't know, and the fact that this was kind of like, yeah, oh, well, you know what happens, is really disturbing.
It is. It's you know, a disturbing sort of symptom of what's going on in our country right now. And I hope that the anniversary will spark some renewed interest in pursuing this investigation. Because, again, the fact that it's a year later and we apparently have no leads and just sort of a ho-hum while we give up, that it just is such a mark of a lack of will for America to succeed, for our country to, you know, overcome our deep partisan divides. This could go a long way towards healing that rift in our culture.
Erica Ahern has been the guest. Check her out on the Loopcast at CatholicVote.org. Erica, thank you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Erica Ahern, maybe you agree, maybe you disagree. Check out what she has to say and more at CatholicVote.org. Listen, it's always going to be a hot-button issue, a hot potato issue, a third-rail issue. But again, above and beyond what people think about this stuff, I mean, folks, it's illegal to protest outside the home, the private homes of federal jurists. And as she mentioned, it went on around this Dobbs leak. It still goes on occasionally today. And our attorney general doesn't seem all that motivated to, you know, send federal law enforcement. I remember at the beginning of this, there was a discussion. Well, you know, and the justices either live usually in Maryland, D.C., or Virginia. Well, is it local law enforcement or is it federal law enforcement? Come on, that's ridiculous. This is, you know, that's the kind of dilly-dallying that happens in banana republics. Get there. Tell the protesters, you know, if you get to a certain point where you're intimidating these people, you know, there's a fine line between legal protest and screaming and yelling and threats. Can you imagine if there was a leak of, you know, something that was near and dear to the hearts of those on the left, you know, immigrants' rights or something like that? Oh, my God, again. Thank my business for turning a blind eye. La, la, la. This would be the lead story on the network newscast.